the dark of night, one light still yet burns. Frightened fingers tremble as brittle pages turn. Fireside Mystery Theater presents The Midnight Reading, a special summer series of dramatic recitations of dark masterpieces in miniature by the masters of the macabre. Hello, I'm James Reeser. Of all the fine writers we're featuring in our series of dark literary classics this summer, only one has the distinction of being a recipient of the Nobel Prize for Literature. Prepare yourself. The same author who penned the classics of Mice and Men, East of Eden, Travels with Charlie, and the enduring masterpiece The Grapes of Wrath also wrote the following bizarre tale of terror, The Affair at 7 Rue de M. Here to read this very rare foray into the world of the macabre by John Steinbeck is the one and only Ali Silva.
I had hoped to withhold from public scrutiny those rather curious events which have given me some concern for the past month. I knew, of course, that there was talk in the neighborhood. I've even heard some of the distortions current in my district, stories, I hasten to add, in which there is no particle of truth. However, my desire for privacy was shattered yesterday by a visit of two members of the Fourth Estate who assured me that the story, or rather a story, had escaped the boundaries of my arrondissement. In the light of impending publicity, I think it only fair to issue the true details of those happenings, which have come to be known as The Affair at 7, Rue de M, in order that nonsense may not be added to a set of circumstances which are not without their bizarrerie. I shall set down the events as they happened, without comment, thereby allowing the public to judge of the situation. At the beginning of the summer, I carried my family to Paris and took up residence in a pretty little house at 7 Rue de M, a building which, in another period, had been the muse of the great house beside it. The whole property is now owned and part of it inhabited by a noble French family of such age and purity that its members still consider the Bourbons unacceptable as claimants to the throne of France. To this pretty little converted stable with three floors of rooms above a well-paved courtyard, I brought my immediate family, consisting of my wife, my three children, two small boys, and a grown daughter, and, of course, myself. Our domestic arrangement, in addition to the concierge, who, as you might say, came with the house, consists of a French cook of great ability, a Spanish maid, and my own secretary, a girl of Swiss nationality whose high attainments and ambitions are only equaled by her moral altitude. This, then, was our little family group when the events I'm about to chronicle were ushered in. If one must have an agency in this matter, I can find no alternative to placing not the blame, but rather the authorship, albeit innocent, on my younger son John, who has only recently attained his eighth year, a lively child of singular beauty and buck teeth. The young man has, during the last several years in America, become not so much an addict as an aficionado of that curious American practice, the chewing of bubble gum. And one of the pleasanter aspects of the early summer in Paris lay in the fact that the cadet John had neglected to bring any of the atrocious substance with him from America. The child's speech became clear and unobstructed, and the hypnotized look went out of his eyes. Alas, this delightful situation was not long to continue. An old family friend traveling in Europe brought as a present to the children a more than adequate supply of this beastly gum, thinking to do them a kindness. Thereupon, the old familiar situation reasserted itself. Speech fought its damp way past a huge wad of gum and emerged with the sound of a faulty water tap. The jaws were in constant motion, giving the face at best a look of agony, while the eyes took on a glaze like those of a pig with a recently severed jugular. Since I do not believe in inhibiting my children, I've resigned myself to a summer not quite so pleasant as I had first hoped. On occasion, I do not follow my ordinary practice of laissez-faire. When I am composing the material for a book or play or essay, in a word, when the utmost of concentration is required, I am prone to establish tyrannical rules for my own comfort and effectiveness. One of these rules is that there shall be neither chewing nor bubbling while I am trying to concentrate. The rule is so thoroughly understood by the cadet John that he accepts it as one of the laws of nature and does not either complain or attempt to evade the ruling. It is his pleasure and my solace for my son to come sometimes into my workroom, there to sit quietly beside me for a time. He knows he must be silent, and when he has remained so for as long a time as his character permits, he goes out quietly, leaving us both enriched by the wordless association. 2 weeks ago, in the late afternoon, I sat at my desk composing a short essay for Figaro Littéraire, an essay which later aroused some controversy when it was printed under the title Salt Resartus. I had come to that passage concerning the proper clothing for the soul, when to my astonishment and chagrin I heard the unmistakable soft plopping sound of a bursting balloon of bubble gum. I looked sternly at my offspring and saw him chewing away. His cheeks were colored with embarrassment and the muscles of his jaw stood rigidly out. "You know the rule," I said coldly. To my amazement, tears came into his eyes, and while his jaws continued to masticate hugely, his blubbery voice forced its way past the huge lump of bubblegum in his mouth.
I didn't do it," he cried.
"What do you mean you didn't do it?" I demanded in a rage. "I distinctly heard, and now I distinctly see."
"Oh, sir,"
he moaned.
I really didn't. I'm not chewing it, sir. It's chewing me."
For a moment, I inspected him closely. He is an honest child, only under the greatest pressure of gain permitting himself an untruth. I had the horrible thought that the bubblegum had finally had its way and that my son's reason was tottering. If this were so, it were better to tread softly. Quietly, I put out my hand. "Lay it here," I said kindly. My child manfully tried to disengage the gum from his jaws.
"It won't let me go,"
he sputtered. "Open up," I said, and then inserting my fingers in his mouth, I seized hold of the large lump of gum and, after a struggle in which my fingers slipped again and again, managed to drag it forth and to deposit the ugly blob on my desk on top of a pile of white manuscript paper. For a moment it seemed to shudder there on the paper, and then, with an easy slowness, it began to undulate, to swell and recede with the exact motion of being chewed, while my son and I regarded it with popping eyes. For a long time we watched it while I drove through my mind for some kind of explanation. Either I was dreaming, or some principle as yet unknown had taken its seat in the pulsing bubblegum on the desk. I am not unintelligent. While I considered the indecent thing, 100 little thoughts and glimmerings of understanding raced through my brain. At last I asked, "How long has it been chewing you?"
"Since last night," he replied.
"And when did you first notice this propensity on its part?" He spoke with perfect candor.
"I will ask you to believe me, sir," he said. "Last night, before I went to sleep, I put it under my pillow, as is my invariable custom. In the night, I was awakened to find that it was in my mouth. I again placed it under my pillow, and this morning it was again in my mouth, lying very quietly. When, however, I became thoroughly awakened, I was conscious of a slight motion, and shortly afterward, the situation dawned on me that I was no longer master of the gum. It had taken its head. I tried to remove it, sir, and could not. You yourself, with all your strength, have seen how difficult it was to extract. I came to your workroom to await your first disengagement, wishing to acquaint you with my difficulty. Oh, Daddy, what do you think has happened?"
The cancerous thing held my complete attention. "I must think," I said. "This is something a little out of the ordinary, and I do not believe it should be passed over without some investigation." As I spoke, a change came over the gum. It ceased to chew itself and seemed to rest for a while. And then, with a flowing movement like those monocellular animals of the order Paramecium, The gum slid across the desk straight in the direction of my son. For a moment, I was stricken with astonishment, and for an even longer time, I failed to discern its intent. It dropped to his knee, climbed horribly up his shirt front. Only then did I understand. It was trying to get back into his mouth. He looked down on it, paralyzed with fright. "Stop!" I cried, for I realized that my third-born was in danger, and at such times I am capable of a violence which verges on the murderous. I seized the monster from his chin and, striding from my workroom, entered the salon, opened the window, and hurled the thing into the busy traffic on the Rue de M. I believe it is the duty of a parent to ward off those shocks which may cause dreams or trauma whenever possible. I went back to my study to find young John sitting where I had left him. He was staring into space. There was a troubled line between his brows. "Son," I said, "you and I have seen something which, while we know it to have happened, we might find difficult to describe with any degree of success to others. I ask you to imagine the scene if we should tell this story to the other members of the family. I greatly fear we should be laughed out of the house."
"Yes, sir," he said passively.
"Therefore, I am going to propose to you, my son, that we lock the episode deep within our memories and never mention it to a soul as long as we live." I waited for his assent, and when it did not come, glanced up at his face to see it a ravaged field of terror. His eyes were starting out of his head. I turned to the direction of his gaze. Under the door there crept a paper-thin sheet, which, once it had entered the room, grew to a gray blob and rested on the rug, pulsing and chewing. After a moment, it moved again by pseudopodean progression toward my son. I fought down my panic as I rushed at it. I grabbed it up and flung it on my desk. Then, seizing an African war club from among the trophies on the wall, a dreadful instrument studded with brass, I beat the gum until I was breathless and it a torn piece of plastic fabric. The moment I rested, it drew itself together and for a few moments chewed very rapidly as though it chuckled at my impotence. And then, inexorably, it moved toward my son, who by this time was crouched in a corner moaning with terror. Now a coldness came over me. I picked up the filthy thing and wrapped it in my handkerchief, strode out of the house, walked 3 blocks to the Seine, and flung the handkerchief into the slowly moving current. I spent a good part of the afternoon soothing my son and trying to reassure him that his fears were over. But such was his nervousness that I had to give him half a barbiturate tablet to get him to sleep that night, while my wife insisted that I call a doctor. I did not, at that time, dare to tell her why I could not obey her wish. I was awakened, indeed the whole house was awakened, in the night by a terrified, muffled scream from the children's room. I took the stairs 2 at a time and burst in the room, flicking the light switch as I went. John sat up in bed, squalling, while with his fingers he dug at his half-open mouth, a mouth which horrifyingly went right on chewing. What chance of keeping our secret now? All had to be explained, but with the plopping gum pinned to a breadboard with an ice pick, the explanation was easier than it might have been. And I am proud of the help and comfort given me. There is no strength like that of a family. Our French cook solved the problem by refusing to believe it even when she saw it. It was not reasonable, she explained, and she was a reasonable member of a reasonable people. The Spanish maid ordered and paid for an exorcism by the parish priest who, poor man, after 2 hours of strenuous effort, went away muttering that this was more a matter of the stomach than the soul. For 2 weeks we were besieged by the monster. We buried it in the fireplace, causing it to splutter in the blue flames and melt in a nasty mess among the ashes. Before morning, it had crawled through the keyhole of the children's room, leaving a trail of wood ash on the door. And again, we were awakened by screams from the cadet. In despair, I drove far into the country and threw it from my automobile. It was back before morning. Apparently, it had crept to the highway and placed itself in the Paris traffic until picked up by a truck tire. When we tore it from John's mouth, it had still the non-skid marks of a Michelin imprinted in its side. Fatigue and frustration will take their toll. In exhaustion, with my will to fight back sapped, and after we had tried every possible method to lose or destroy the bubblegum, I placed it at last under a bell jar, which I ordinarily used to cover my microscope. I collapsed in a chair to gaze at it with weary, defeated eyes. John slept in his little bed under the influence of sedatives, backed by my assurance that I would not let the thing out of my sight. I lighted a pipe and settled back to watch it. Inside the bell jar, the gray, tumorous lump moved restlessly about, searching for some means of exit from its prison. Now and then it paused, as in thought, and emitted a bubble in my direction. I could feel the hatred it had for me. In my weariness, I had found my mind slipping into an analysis which had so far escaped me. The background I had been over hurriedly. It must be that from constant association with the lambent life which is my son, the magic of life had been created in the bubblegum. And with life had come intelligence, not the manly open intelligence, but an evil, calculating wiliness. How could it be otherwise? Intelligence without the soul to balance it must of necessity be evil. The gum had not absorbed any part of John's soul. Very well, said my mind, now we have a hypothesis of its origin. Let us consider its nature. What does it think? What does it want? What does it need? My mind leaped like a terrier. It needs and wants to get back to its host, my son. It wants to be chewed. It must be chewed to survive. Inside the bell jar, the gum inserted a thin wedge of itself under the heavy glass foot and constricted so that the whole jar lifted a fraction of an inch. I laughed as I drove it back. I laughed with almost insane triumph. I had the answer. In the dining room, I procured a clear plastic plate, one of a dozen my wife had bought for picnics in the country. Then, turning the bell jar over and securing the monster in its bottom, I smeared the mouth of it with a heavy plastic cement guaranteed to be water, alcohol, and acid-proof. I forced the plate over the opening and pressed it down until the glue took hold and bound the plate to the glass, making an airtight container. And last, I turned the jar upright again and adjusted the reading light so that I could observe every movement of my prisoner. Again, it searched the circle for escape. Then it faced me and emitted a great number of bubbles very rapidly. I could hear the little bursting plops through the glass. "I have you, my beauty," I cried. "I have you at last." That was a week ago. I have not left the side of the bell jar since, and have only turned my head to accept a cup of coffee. When I go to the bathroom, my wife takes my place. I can now report the following hopeful news. During the first day and night, the bubblegum tried every means to escape. Then, for a day and a night, it seemed to be agitated and nervous, as though it had, for the first time, realized its predicament. The third day, it went to work with its chewing motion, only the action was speeded up greatly, like the chewing of a baseball fan. On the fourth day, it began to weaken, and I observed with joy a kind of dryness on its once slick and shiny exterior. I am now in the seventh day, and I believe it is almost over. The gum is lying in the center of the plate. At intervals, it heaves and subsides. Its color has turned to a nasty yellow. Once today, when my son entered the room, it leaped up excitedly, then seemed to realize its hopelessness and collapsed on the plate. It will die tonight, I think. And only then will I dig a deep hole in the garden, and I will deposit the sealed bell jar and cover it up and plant geraniums over it. It is my hope that this account will set straight some of the silly tales that are being hawked in the neighborhood.
That was The Affair at 7 Rue de M, written by John Steinbeck and read by Ali Silva. We're pretty certain that the story you just heard will really stick with you. Will it creep into your dreams tonight? We'll let you chew on that for a while. The affair at 7 Rue de M first appeared in Harper's Bazaar magazine in 1955. It was originally titled The Affair at 1 Rue de M, which referenced the actual address of Steinbeck's Paris residence at the time. The story is really unlike anything else we've come across in Steinbeck's vast canon. It floated around in near total obscurity until it was finally collected in an expanded edition of the portable Steinbeck that appeared in the mid-1970s, which is still available today from Penguin Books. For those of you who have read little to no Steinbeck, this book is a great introduction to the American master. It includes self-contained excerpts from novels such as The Grapes of Wrath, Tortilla Flat, Cannery Row, the complete novellas The Red Pony and Of Mice and Men, his Nobel Prize acceptance speech, as well as the short story you just heard. The Midnight Reading is produced by Gustavo Rodriguez and Ali Silva for Fireside Mystery Productions, with direction by Holly Payne Strange. Our audio engineers are Bill and Delaney Hafner. This series was recorded at Silo Studios in Shirley, New York. It was written by Sylvan Sandovar. Our theme music is by Martina Da Silva. Don't miss upcoming installments of The Midnight Reading, as well as recordings of our live show by subscribing to the Fireside Mystery Theater podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. A rating or review on iTunes would be most valued and appreciated. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter and Instagram, where our handle is @FiresideMystery. Pick up some Fireside Mystery Theater swag on our merch page at FiresideMysteryTheater.com. And for those of you in the New York City area, mark your calendars. Fireside Mystery Theater returns to the stage for a brand new season of thrilling and chilling original radio drama. On Sunday, October 1st, 2017 at 2 p.m., we shall be at the Bickford Theater at the Morris Museum in Morristown, New Jersey for a show we call Sing the Old Alma Mater. Tickets on sale soon at morrismuseum.org. This is James Reeser, encouraging you to go out there and allow yourself to explore and discover the seductive allure of dark literature at your local bookstore or library. Thank you, kind listeners, for joining us. And until next time, be sure to mind the shadows.